Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Friday, March 1st. I'm your host, Stephen Overly. In the 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, one of the ways the U.S. has tried to strangle Russia is with heavy restrictions on tech exports. The idea being that it would hobble Russia's ability to make equipment for the battlefield. But those controls haven't been as effective as originally hoped. Moscow's economy and military have proven resilient. Plus, a constant stream of workarounds has allowed Russia to keep buying black market technology, dragging the war into a third year. Max Bergman has been tracking these export controls since the start of the war. He's the director of the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia Group at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. On the show today, Max tells me why cutting Russia off is so hard and why the next U.S. president will make a big difference. Max, welcome to Politico Tech.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been 2 years since the U.S. started restricting the sale of microchips, navigation equipment, and other critical technologies to Russia. This technology is still getting through. Why is that the case?
It's the case because these are hard things to control. These are oftentimes commercial technologies that can be used for military purposes, but are regulated, at least inside of the U.S., not in a military way, but in a commercial way, which makes it difficult for the United States to have sort of full insight into where sales of technology is going. This is true for many companies as well, who suddenly get a contract order from maybe a company in Turkey, from a company in Central Asia, and they think, great, we have a contract, we have a deal. And what this is oftentimes either the Russian intelligence service using workarounds, creating fake LLCs, or just other profit-seeking entities realizing that there's a way, a black market of funneling technology into Russia. So I think the mistake from a policy perspective is oftentimes viewing that once we put in export controls and sanctions, as these things are foolproof and that there's going to be no leakage. There's inevitably going to be leakage. And that's, I think, one of the things that we've seen over the last 2 years is that a country like Russia is going to try to adapt. And then the question is, what do we do in response? And it's very much a policy and administrative cat and mouse game.
2 years into all of this, would you say that the Russian economy or military is weaker today as a result of these export controls than it was when this started?
Well, yes and no. I think what we've seen is that if you were to take the average Russian tank coming off the production lines right now and compare it to the tank that was coming off the production lines a few years ago, I think you would say the answer is absolutely yes. The technology isn't as strong. Oftentimes we saw with Russia was using a really advanced, for instance, French optical system for their tanks so they could further and clearer on the battlefield. And suddenly the screws were tightened and the Russians weren't getting their hands on that technology. So I think quality of the individual systems are getting worse. However, Russia's production is going up because what they've done is they've shifted to essentially a wartime economy where a lot more money is going into production, a lot more resources, a lot more just energy on behalf of the state to try to acquire replacement parts and components and technologies that can be used to maybe not get you to where you were a few years ago, but the kind of good enough level is where the Russians are operating. And what they found is that they can ramp up production and find a replacement technology that can meet their needs.
Well, I want to talk about where that replacement technology is coming from, because Russia has found ways to buy restricted technologies through back channels that seem to be beyond the reach of the U.S. How exactly is the Kremlin circumventing these restrictions?
Well, I think you have to look to the big country to their south, and that's China. There was a lot of concern basically this time a year ago, exactly almost, where there was real concern that China was about to just straight up arm Russia. It hasn't done that yet, but what it has done is open its economy and said, okay, companies go trade with Russia. And China is now Russia's largest trading partner. It's replaced the European Union. And we see lots of technology, parts and components, other critical machine tools that perhaps used to be produced by the Germans are now being produced by the Chinese going into the Russian defense industry. So Russia is being able to go to China, and China is essentially the world's manufacturer. And so they have a lot of capacity and technology, and it may not be quite as good as, you know, what we have in the U.S. when we're producing weapons or what the Europeans have. But again, if you're hitting that kind of good enough standard where perhaps that missile isn't as accurate as it should be, and it's going to maybe miss its target, you know, 10% more of the time or 20% more of the time. But for the Russians right now, that's just fine.
And I know the U.S. tries to counteract this. The Commerce Department will put companies on what's called an entity list. That means they're limited in the sales they can do with U.S. companies. A few dozen companies were just added to the entity list again recently. Does that have an impact, or is Russia able to find alternatives even with those countermeasures?
I think it does have an impact. And I think part of what the U.S. is trying to do is not simply hit those companies. And so that is oftentimes a significant temporary disruption. So Russia has to find workarounds. So you create a sort of temporary disruption. But then you're also sending a message to other companies that, like, no, this is something that the U.S. is paying attention to. And so maybe there's some big order coming in from Kazakhstan that we're probably not going to fulfill because, man, we kind of know where this is going. And I think it causes companies to ask further questions. But it also gets to, what are sanctions and export controls about? And I think there's this sort of glib answer oftentimes that sanctions and export controls have failed when it comes to Russia because A, they didn't deter Putin in the first place from launching his invasion, and B, haven't gotten him to stop. And what I would say is that may be true. They failed if that is your definition of success, is just sort of bring down the Russian economy. But I would view it more as, just as Ukraine is in a war of attrition and we provide the Ukrainians artillery, and it's not like every artillery shot fired, they're like, well, did that end the war? The answer is, it attrited your opponent. And I think what we're trying to do, what the U.S. is trying to do in the West, is really attrit the Russian economy. And I think it's having an impact. Now, whether that leads to kind of broader strategic effects is still, I think, in some ways too soon to tell. But the Russian economy is really under some real strain.
You briefly mentioned Kazakhstan there, which is one of the countries, and there's a list of them, that have sort of been accused of providing alternative trade routes to Russia or helping Russia to acquire some of this technology that has been forbidden. What is the role of some of these third-party countries in facilitating these transactions?
They play a really important, significant role for Russia. And part of it is that they are still oftentimes able to do trade with particularly the Europeans. We've seen a lot of trade from German companies into Central Asia. And look, these countries have a shared history. They used to be part of the Soviet Union, and they're in a tough neighborhood in which the Russians squeeze them. They also, sometimes the countries don't have full control over what's happening in their economies. And I think this is a major point of leakage when it comes to the sanctions and export control system. And, you know, this then becomes both, I think, a diplomatic issue for the United States and Europe about potential secondary sanctions and how much are we going to kind of try to turn the screws on these countries. But then it's also about going to the companies in our own countries and telling them to sort of knock it off, that we know what you're doing and that you need to stop this, because those sales are not going to Kazakhstan, but they're going to Russia, and you really need to know your customer. And so I think there's a degree of just additional bureaucratic energy and effort that needs to go into cracking down on this. But I think it's a very vital avenue for Russia to get a lot of advanced technology and other specialized European machine tools, things like that, that are then fueling the Russian defense industry.
Lawmakers have singled out some companies like Intel, AMD, Analog Devices, and Texas Instruments, where there are reports that their technology is still showing up in Russian equipment. And companies say they comply with, you know, sanctions and export controls. What more can companies be doing to cut off that supply or to be more compliant with these restrictions?
It's a tough question, and I think it probably varies from company to company, depending on their supply chain, depending on where they've sold technology. It may be that some of this is technology that's been sold years ago and has been sitting in a warehouse somewhere else, and then the company has sort of no knowledge or insight that someone is selling it to a third party. And I think that's the challenge here with especially this commercial technology. And part of the reason why we kind of know that it's ending up still in Russian defense factories is because it's appearing on the Ukrainian battlefield, where an advanced Russian missile lands in a city. The Ukrainians get it. They rip it apart. They find the parts and components. And there's something made from Texas Instruments or Intel. And they have egg on their face. And I have to say, that's a big deterrent to these companies. They don't want to be seen as providing the technology that is being used to, you know, kill Ukrainians. So I think they are doing a lot. And I think the policymakers' expectations is that they keep doing a lot. And the policymakers' challenge is that we can't just take their word for it. There has to be a degree of checking, making sure, you know, we have Department of Justice lawyers going out examining this, that the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. intelligence community is on this and trying to identify sanctions violators. I think that creates a degree of concern amongst a lot of companies that they could be on the wrong end of the U.S. government on this.
You know, my Politico colleagues reported recently that the U.S. can only put so much pressure on other countries to cut off sales to Russia, you know, which ultimately can make these export controls less effective. I'm curious, from your perspective, what are some of the big geopolitical challenges the U.S. faces that might hinder its ability to actually really enforce these export controls?
Yeah, it's a dance. So take a country like Turkey, right? We know that Turkey, similar to many of the Central Asian countries, is acting, there are many Turkish companies that are essentially acting as conduits for exports to Russia, and many European countries are selling to Turkey. So if you think about this from a diplomatic perspective, well, up until a few months ago, what was the overriding U.S. priority when it came to Turkey? Well, it was getting Sweden into NATO. So if you started to throw the book at Turkish companies and secondary sanctions and made this the top priority, well, is Erdogan, what is he going to do, the president of Turkey, when it comes to Sweden? And so there's a balance that has to be played with many of these countries. But are we going to essentially destroy the relationship? Another country like this is India, where the U.S. is desperate to build strong ties, but the Indians have had, you know, decades long relationship with the Russians. And, you know, we have demonstrated that we're not actually willing to go after India with secondary sanctions, despite the fact that they are still have a very robust military defense relationship with the Russian defense industry, or buying Russian oil, and also acting as a conduit for a lot of smuggled Russian technology. And what you hope happens is that these countries start to see that actually we want to be in the good graces of the United States. You have to stop, or else it'll have real consequences for the relationship. And that makes a difference, or can make a difference.
I mean, so many of these factors you're talking about are just beyond, or seemingly beyond, U.S. control. Some of these geopolitical dimensions, the decisions other countries make to route this equipment to Russia. Is there more that the U.S. can or should be doing to enforce existing export controls or impose further ones?
The answer is yes. And that basically the people who are working this problem at the Commerce Department, the Treasury Department, and the U.S. government should stop sleeping and should just keep working hard. And there's no end to this. And I think this has to be viewed as essentially an intense bureaucratic whack-a-mole effort. And you may say, my God, well, you're never going to kill all the moles. And you're entirely right. But what you're trying to do is cause so much disruption to the Russian war effort, where Russia thinks it has, you know, a steady stream of supplies of this sort of technology, where hence it can now really ramp up missile production. And suddenly, boom, you stop that. And then it forces the Russians to figure out, okay, well, we have this other conduit through this country, well, we'll do that. And then it maybe works for a week and then it stops. And so the Russian defense industry is just, it's fits and starts, where it can't really get going. And that's what success looks like here. And the other aspect of this is that it has to be go hand in hand. And this is where I think the U.S. deserves some criticism, is that we've been very reticent to go after Russia's main source of revenue, and that's Russian oil. We have not wanted that to come off the global marketplace. Now, that doesn't directly tie to the export controls, but what we're doing is essentially raising costs for the Russians. That increases inflation in Russia, but Russia is able to bankroll this because it still can sell Russian oil. And I know we're, you know, in election season and no one wants to see high oil prices, but, you know, perhaps if Biden wins re-election, like, this could be something to look at, of clamping down on Russian oil production. And then suddenly, maybe Russia can't pay the smugglers and other suppliers the exorbitant costs that are being charged to them because they're running out of revenue. And that's the kind of back and forth that you're trying to do with the energy sanctions, financial sanctions, and then tying that to the export controls.
The recent death of Alexei Navalny, you know, the Russian opposition politician, prompted a bunch of new export controls and sanctions on Russia from the U.S. Do you foresee those having any greater impact or different impact from what we've seen to date?
There was nothing in them that struck me as transformative. I think it's in some ways, if I were to kind of guess what was happening inside of the administration, even before Alexei Navalny's death, was that there was, okay, the second anniversary of the war is coming up. We know that
we gotta do something.
Yeah. We gotta do something. But we also know that you have to issue new sanctions packages every few months. When I was in the Obama administration, you know, these are sanctions maintenance packages. You know, there's a degree of maintenance that has to go on to ensure that they're still having an impact. And I think that's what a lot of these were, are sort of updates. The company that we sanctioned, the Russians have now changed the name. It's operating under a different LLC. We identify it, and now we need to sanction that one. And so so is this a game changer? No. Is it part of sort of good governance when it comes to enforcing sanctions? Yes. And I think that does have an impact in gradually degrading the Russian economy.
So as we enter the third year of this conflict, do you think anything will be different?
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, look, what I would say is that, you know, we have oftentimes think of the war in Ukraine now as a war of attrition. And that is sort of oftentimes portrayed as a stalemate, as it's never going to change. And it's sort of analogy is oftentimes made to World War One. But what we forget about World War One is the German lines eventually broke. So right now, I think the actual war has sort of shifted against Ukraine, part because the U.S. isn't providing military aid, which is basically the most important thing we could do. But I do think that the Russian economy has been running hot. Russia is spending a ton in a sort of Keynesian wartime economy. It's having to spend a lot of money to get all this technology and parts and components and other things. And so inflation is high. And I think they are potentially prone to real macroeconomic disruption down the road.
One big factor here in the U.S., obviously, is the election in November. Do you have a sense of what impact the outcome of that election could have on whether the U.S. sort of stays the course with these export controls and sanctions or takes a different tack when it comes to addressing the war?
It's a great question. It's a big question. What I would say is, I think if, you know, obviously if President Biden wins, I think you could potentially see more of the same. I do think that there would probably be, I would hope there potentially would be a willingness to risk some broader global inflationary effects by going after Russian oil. So I think we could see a bit of a stronger approach on some of the areas of the Russian economy that may impact the United States. If Trump wins, I think it's a whole different ballgame, because then what happens is that the administrative state, quote unquote, that is the deep state that are the ones doing the enforcement, suddenly they're not sure if that's what the president wants, because the president of the United States, if it's Trump, may not be in favor of doing the sanctions and export controls. And I think that's the clear indication that we've been getting from Donald Trump. And so then you see people going home early. You see less willingness to kind of do additional sanctions maintenance packages. And so the effect of sanctions then basically evaporate over time. And maybe they're not taken off the books, but Russia's adapted and the U.S. isn't really doing very much to enforce them. And we saw some of that, I think, during the first Trump administration. And I think that would potentially be the case in the second Trump administration.
Well, Max, appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Politico Tech.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here on Monday.